So again, I want to say thank you for joining us this evening. I believe I'd introduced myself, but I will do so again in case I didn't. My name is Pastor Adam Falkenstein. I am the pastor of adult discipleship here in North Homestead Friends Church. Welcome to our 11 o'clock service. As Kieran shared earlier, it is a bit more of an intimate setting. Obviously, there's fewer of us here, but it's actually something I really prefer. Was at the 5 o'clock service today, and it was packed, and it was awesome to see our sanctuary filled with so many people. But there's something about the intimacy of the 11 o'clock service and just the way that we come together in a small community to kind of usher in Christmas morning that it is very, very special for me. About 7 years ago was the first time we really did something like this. We had not done a late night Christmas Eve service here at the church before then. And at the time, our senior pastor, Pastor Jeff, we kind of had to convince him that this was a good idea. Because when we said, you know, it would be really cool if we could have a service that led into Christmas morning, his first response was, who's going to do that? Specifically, who's going to lead it? I think he likes to sleep. I'm getting older, and I'm starting to understand. But at the time, I was about, you know, it was about 8 years ago, seven, 8 years ago, so I had a little bit more spring in my step at that time. And so I jumped at the chance to be able to lead this service because amongst many aspects of studying Scripture, one of the things that I really love to do is more in-depth research on who the people are in these stories that we hear about all the time. So often, what ends up happening is we read Scripture, or we hear it preached to us, and we kind of gloss over. We get this sense of familiarity, but not really knowing who these people were. And they become more familiar with time as we come to know their names and maybe the stories they're associated with, but we don't really pause and think about who they were and why they're included in God's narrative. And over the years, one of the things that we've done, one of the things that I've done, I've loved to do this on Christmas Eve at 11 o'clock, is character studies. Look at these people that we hear referenced year in and year out and really figure out who they were, why God chose them, why are they a part of the Christmas story. And so I played it safe the first year. We did the shepherds, right, because that's the easy one. And then we did the wise men, and then we tackled Simeon, and a couple years ago, when my daughter was born, she was about a month old at the time that Christmas came around, so I said, not this year, I can't. I was very grateful for Pastor Adrian, who took over that year, and she did a sermon on Anna. We've also discussed the innkeeper. Last year, I even formed our entire message around the inn, because I think that actually counts as a character. It's referenced enough. The very stable that Joseph and Mary would have stayed in. It's fair to say, as time has gone on, we've kind of been leading into territory with the Christmas story that is less considered or maybe even unfamiliar. One might say these messages are a touch unconventional. Some of you who are joining us this evening for the first time, you may have been experiencing something more akin to a Catholic Mass when you came to an 11 p.m. service. So I'm sure when we did Christmas trivia with Pez dispensers, you were a little thrown. But we like to make, you know, keep you on your toes. It's about changing how we approach this morning. And that was kind of the idea behind these unconventional and unfamiliar messages. It's kind of the point for us to think on the things at Christmas that we often tend to forget about in place of the traditions and the trappings. That's not to say that those traditions are somehow a bad thing. One of the things that I love about the Christmas season is watching Christmas movies. In fact, my daughter that I just mentioned, her name is Gwen. My wife and I actually have two children now. We have a four-month-old son named Rowan. He's actually going to be 4 months old tomorrow, which is kind of cool. Four-month-old named Rowan, and then our daughter Gwen. And Gwen is two. She just turned two. And one of the things I have loved this year is starting to see the world again through a new, fresh set of eyes. I get to see it through her eyes. I get to see the wonder of everything around her as she begins to explore and understand and really experience life. And Christmas has been an amazing experience to watch her kind of come to life in. So, of course, because I love Christmas movies, I took it upon myself to begin introducing some of those Christmas classics to her, specifically a good portion of the old Rankin-Bass specials. You guys know those ones, right? We all know what I'm talking about, right? Claymation, Rudolph, Frosty, all those. Okay, we're on. Okay, so whenever we're out in public now and she sees a snowman, she goes, "Hi, Frosty." And it's so adorable. Or she sees a reindeer, it's, "Hi, Rudolph." It's absolutely adorable. But it's also a little odd because this guy, Bumble, he's the abominable snow monster. This is like her favorite character. It's a little weird. He's from the Rudolph special. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Because I'm just insane, I just took it upon myself to buy stuffed animals of all of these characters for her. And Bumble is without a doubt her favorite. It's about as big as she is, and she just cuddles with him. She like holds him and she's like, "I love you, Bumble." And I'm like, "What is going on? What is wrong with you?" He's the bad guy, right? And that's kind of what makes it odd, right? He's one of the villains in Rudolph's story. Right up until, if you've never seen Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, right? At the very end, there's this guy. He's throughout the entire movie. His name's Yukon Cornelius, right? He's like this old-timer, like prospector character. And he tames Bumble the snow monster, and they become friends. It's really cute, right? And we actually see that theme show up a lot in Christmas stories. There's always like a villain who seems to be against the protagonist's sense of Christmas spirit, and then by the end of the story he ends up reformed, right? They see the error of their ways and they come to embrace the beauty of the Christmas season. We have this guy, the Grinch, right, whose heart grows 3 sizes, and he saves Christmas, where before he wanted to put an end to it, right? We have Scrooge, right, who's an old miser. He's greedy, right, and he recognizes instead it's more important to be generous and giving than to hoard his wealth. We have Frank Shirley, right, the boss of Clark Griswold, who comes to understand that a 1-year subscription to the Jelly of the Month Club does not a Christmas bonus make. Last one's a bit of a stretch, but we kind of see where I'm going here, right? There's this theme that we kind of see repeated in Christmas stories, that the true meaning, the spirit of Christmas, will always prevail. All that being said, tonight's message is one, because of these character studies that I've been doing for almost a decade, one I knew would eventually come, one that I knew would be challenging. Not only because of the fact that tonight's character is one we don't really often study, but he's one we would rather not study. It's not really even a Christmas message I wanted to preach. This was hard for me to write. But as time has gone on and I've experienced more in my life, I've kind of come to this realization that to ignore the realities, the real realities of Christmas, in favor of the good feelings, is to ignore the very purpose of why Christmas exists. I'm talking about Herod. You should know that based on the bulletin you received when you came in. So tonight, if you would please stand with me as we read from Matthew chapter 2, the gospel account that mentions this king named Herod. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel.'" Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so it was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. You may be seated. Herod's name appears more than just in the account of Matthew. And so it's important for us to understand there were more than one. For the purposes of our message this evening, we are discussing the first Herod, also known as Herod the Great, also known as Herod, King of the Jews. However, Herod really was not a Jew, but rather he was an Edomite. It means he was a descendant of Esau, the brother of Jacob, who would later be given the name Israel by God, the true father of the Jewish people. At the time of Herod the First, there had actually been intermarriage between Jews and Edomites, and Herod publicly declared himself a Jew in spite of the fact that he had no reverence for nor adherence to Jewish law. So it should stand as no surprise to us then when he was appointed as the governor of Galilee in northern Israel, and the Jewish dynasty came into conflict with Rome, the power-hungry Herod sided with the Romans, who he saw as the mightier force. And because of his fealty, because he bowed to them, he was given that title, King of the Jews, by the Roman Senate. And he was tasked with conquering the region of Judea to rule as a client king for Rome. In his role, Herod's primary responsibility was to carry out the will of Rome and foster goodwill with the people. And for Herod, the promise of notoriety fueled his ego. And so he did actually, in fact, help to reduce taxes for the people. And he worked towards economic prosperity. And he's even credited with overseeing some of the largest public works projects ever seen in the region. Of course, the motivation for all of these projects would not have been out of a genuine care and concern for the people, but for his name to be made great. And Herod would take this all one step further by building a literal monument to himself called the Herodium. This is an image of what we think it might have looked like. It's a structure that was literally a man-made mountain. It was almost half a mile high. It was built to house 1,000 soldiers and the royal family for up to a year, with rooms to store food and water. It had a pool that was twice the size of our modern-day Olympic pools. It had gardens like you'd never seen, decorations and artwork that would put any modern palace to shame. It's believed that the Herodium, this monument to Herod's regality and authority, might have been the largest palace ever constructed. And yet this was not enough to convince Herod of his greatness. That ego that he worked so hard to inflate and boast of was, as you might suspect, incredibly fragile. Herod lived in fear of potential rivals. And he did his best to remove any obstacles that there might be to his growing power. He had his wife's brother, who was the high priest, drowned in that same pool in his palace. He had 46 members of the Sanhedrin, the royal priesthood, murdered. He killed his own mother-in-law. He even eventually had his second wife, Mariamne, and two of their sons murdered because she was of Hasmonean descent. She was a Jew. And so she and they had more of a legitimate blood claim to the Jewish throne than he did. This is the type of man that Herod was. And this unfortunate behavior is one that we have seen historically again and again from leaders who covet power and glory and are distant from their creator. But the irony for Herod is that for all intents and purposes, he had numerous connections to God. Though he was not Jewish by birth, his adjacent connections and later his kingly position and his marital relationship to Mariamne would have given him proximity to those well-versed in the prophecies of the Messiah. And then when the Magi came to visit him, these wise scholars who've traveled a great distance to seek Christ, he's given news that the King of the Jews has been born. Well, obviously that sent up a red flag for him. His advisors would confirm the word of the prophets. The child is to be born in Bethlehem. He knew as much as anyone could know about the true message, the point, the purpose of Christmas. And yet for Herod, there is no redemption. His story does not end with a feel-good, happy ending. He completely misses it. This king of the Jews simply hears of another threat to his power, and he seeks to put a stop to it. And he enacts an unthinkable edict to end the lives of any boys who fit the description of Christ in demographic and residence. See, in the Christmas story, Herod is the outlier. His inclusion does not feel like it fits. In the story of the humble birth of Christ, the Son of God leaving his cosmic heavenly throne to be born in squalor and filth into a situation of shame and scorn, this figure of covetous power and violence and greed being a prominent player, he sticks out like a broken Christmas bulb. You know, in any Christmas play that I've ever seen or been a part of or helped to do, this is the hardest part to cast because nobody wants to be Herod. Nobody wants to play this part. One of the other Christmas traditions that I love is putting up decorations. In particular, I love collecting vintage decorations, especially blow molds. I don't know if you guys know what those are, but they're the giant plastic figures that light up. But I don't want the modern day LED ones that have like the switch on the back. I want the ones that stand really tall and they have some wear to them and you might risk blowing a fuse or burning your house down when you plug them in. Those are the ones that I like, right? Just this past year, I was finally able, after much searching, to acquire on a budget an older set of Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. It's outside in front of our house right now. I still have to collect a shepherd and some wise men and probably a little sheep at some point, but you know who you never see in the nativity scene? Herod. Everybody wants to forget about him. Another tradition I love is Christmas lights. It was so beautiful this year to take my kids out and watch my daughter Gwen ooh and ah at the sight of all of the displays. But in the midst of that beauty, there's a very real and present threat of darkness that is seeking to extinguish the light. We can't ignore that. See, we tend to leave Herod out because his inclusion in the story threatens our perception of what Christmas is supposed to be. Or maybe, it might be better said, it threatens what we've made it to be. See, culturally, Christmas has become a time of beauty and wonder, of celebrations and cheer, of making merry. It's the sweet sighing of a newborn babe. But during that first Christmas season, it was soldiers marching down the streets with swords in their hands, and mothers hiding in the back rooms of their homes, holding their newborn sons close, rocking them and hoping beyond all hope that they would not cry. It's not a surprise that we want to leave Herod out. It doesn't even feel good to talk about him. But we can't leave him out. And we shouldn't. God included him in the story for a reason. And that's because we need to understand the tragedy in order to fully appreciate the triumph. We don't have hymns or carols that mention Herod, but Christmas is not about any traditional or cultural event that we might have manufactured. In fact, Herod's inclusion in the story might be, this might be a bold thing for me to say, but it might be the second most important part of the Christmas story after the actual birth of Christ. Because when we remember the story, we have to remember all of it. That yes, there is great evil in this world, and it is caused by sin. There are many people tonight who are suffering the loss of loved ones or grieving friends and family who will not be present at the table tomorrow. There are many who may have even lost a loved one today. There are brothers and sisters on the other side of the world engulfed in conflict because of people as wicked as Herod. But the first truth about Christmas is that God comes to the worst places in the world, in the midst of our worst pain and suffering, and he shares in it with us. He cares for us in our tragedies. He bears our sorrows. The first truth of Christmas is about the fact that God has seen our pain and our suffering and our sin and our death, and he has responded to it with hope and redemption. But we also need to remember that we are all just as guilty. We are just as at fault of wanting to be the Lord of our own lives the same way that Herod did. Sin causes us also to be greatly wicked and greedy and arrogant, where we refuse to humble ourselves and we instead crave power to feed our egos. Our sin has no doubt caused suffering for many other people that we are likely not even aware of. And so the second truth of Christmas, the hope that we have, is that in spite of the wickedness of Herod, in spite of the wickedness of the world, yes, even in spite of the wickedness of ourselves, God looked at us in our affliction of sin and said, "You are worth it to me, and I'm going to prove it to you." It's for this very reason that Christ came into this world, to eradicate the evil in the hearts of men and draw us instead into perfect love. And just like Herod, we are given the same choice. Will I reject this child or accept his gift? Come and truly bow before him in worship as my king. Final note tonight, and a reminder to all of us of not only who the true king of the Jews is, but also the king of the universe. See, Mary and Joseph had to travel south from Nazareth to Bethlehem. The Herodium that I spoke of earlier, that great monument to Herod, it's actually just about 3 miles southeast of Bethlehem. Even today, the mountain on which it stood is still visible to the naked eye from Bethlehem. You can see it in the distance. There's no doubt that Mary and Joseph would have been able to see it in all of its glory on their way to the town of David, not yet knowing that their son's first great enemy was less than a day's journey away from them, living inside of its walls. But this is the beautiful part. That palace is now in ruins. Herod's kingdom is all but forgotten. His name and his legacy is relegated to history books and scripture, but his reign is no more. As with all earthly kingdoms, it has fallen. For all of his power, Herod truly had none. For all the might that he tried to exercise and the prestige that he tried to garner, it ultimately meant nothing. And yet, just 3 miles away, a stone's throw distance, in a small, dark stable, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords was being brought into the world to establish a kingdom that would have no end. Whereas Herod's kingdom continued to die with each passing generation, Christ's kingdom has only continued to advance, grow, and thrive. Tonight, maybe you're experiencing a season of darkness. Maybe you're here bearing a burden that makes it hard for you to experience joy when everyone else seems joyful. You walked in here because you felt like you should be here, but you don't really know why. Maybe you have a very real enemy in your life that seems to have it out for you. Maybe it's just been one attack after another on your life that feels like it's never going to let up. Understand this. The King of the universe is well acquainted with grief, sorrow, and suffering. And he has not left you to bear it alone. We have been sent redemption from eternal suffering. The reason we sing joy to the world is because God kept his promise to us. The promise that in spite of our earthly pain, in spite of anything that this world or any person can throw at us, we have eternal hope. We have been given a joy that is deeper than our sadness. We have been given a life that is more powerful than death, and a light that cannot be extinguished by darkness. His name is Jesus. Will you bow before him with me this evening as we come together in worship? Will you pray with me? Father, I don't want to be a man who forgets that this world is ugly, because you see it so much more clearly than any of us do. And God, I feel like if we truly understood just how dark, what goes on behind the scenes, the things that we cannot see, the things in the spiritual realm, Lord, that afflict us and are influencing us, Lord, if we truly understood darkness, God, I can't even imagine. I can't imagine how you looked into that darkness and saw us in our affliction of our sin and said, you're worth it. But that's the kind of God that you are. You are a God of love. You are a God of redemption. You are a God who looks at sinful, wicked people who are undeserving of salvation and say, but you're mine, and I want you. God, thank you for wanting us. Thank you for the journey that Jesus began in that manger, Lord, the journey towards the cross, because that's what this celebration is, Lord, that hope has come. Our salvation is here, but it does not stop here. This is not the end of the story. It is the beginning of the work, Lord, that you were accomplishing through Christ's life on this earth. May we not forget that Herod exists in this story for a reason, to remind us of the darkness that is in each of us, Lord, of the sin that we are at war against and our need for Jesus, because we can strip away the decorations, God. We can take away the carols. We can take away the cookies. We can take away everything. And Jesus is still there, and he's still the point. He's still the purpose. He's at the center of everything. It is only because of him that we have any hope of eternity, Lord. And if one person hears this message tonight and recognizes their own Herod-like attitude, whereas Herod looked on Christ and saw an enemy, Lord, let us not see an enemy. May we receive him, this gift that you've given to us, Lord. Receive him fully. May we never forget, God, that there's a point to all of this. And it's not just a feel-good message. It is meant to draw us closer into intimacy with you so that we would know you more and follow Jesus more closely, that we would model our lives after him, Lord. As we sing of that silent night, Lord, let us remember that even in the midst of that evening, Mary was experiencing her own encounter with Christ. And all of the hardships she would endure as a mother because of what Jesus would have to go through, Lord. The journey did not stop there. The birth of Christ was not the end of the journey. It was the start. It was the start of your plan because you love us. May we reject that wickedness in our hearts that tells us that we are greater, that we are the Lord of our own lives, that we have no need for Jesus, and may we instead come and bow before him in worship, recognize him as King, completely humble ourselves to him and say, Jesus, you are all that I need. You are all that matters. Take my life. Change me. Transform me. Make me a new creation the way that only you can. We thank you, Lord, that you did not sanitize your words so that we could just feel good. You kept the ugly parts in so that we would have to stop and pause and remember. There's a purpose behind all of it, and his name is Jesus. And it is for our good so that we can be restored to holiness with you. Thank you, Father, for that truth. That in our sin, Christ died for us. We praise his name tonight, the name above all other names, Jesus Christ.